Right then, brethren, the last few weeks we've been looking at the topic of trials and tribulations and obstacles and difficulties. And we've said, as the scripture points out, that we'll all face trials. It's through much tribulation that you and I must enter the kingdom of God. Hopefully, we've seen also that actually trials and tribulations are common to all mankind. And equally, hopefully, we've seen that they don't generally come from God. He often gets the blame, but by and large, God's not the one behind our difficulties, our trials, and our obstacles. They're not His way of building us up and making us stronger spiritually. In fact, trials, difficulties, obstacles often come our way to divert us from God's ways, to damage us, or ultimately, in some cases, to destroy us, and sometimes succeed. And we mentioned before there are probably at least two broad areas where difficulties and obstacles come from. One is the regrettable consequence of our own actions. We make certain choices, we make certain decisions, and there are consequences. That's what they call the law of sowing and reaping. If you sow to the flesh, then there's a certain outcome. You will reap destruction. The other area is Satan and his demons. They have a large part to play in the difficulties, the obstacles, the frustrations that you and I face. And that's the area I want to concentrate on over the next couple of weeks. You know, we live in a physical world, a material world. You're probably sitting in a chair or lying in a carpet or maybe still lying in bed. You've got a car out in the driveway, there's a house, there's a fridge, there's food inside it. We live in towns or cities or wherever, and we're all really very much wrapped up in the physical, material world. It's natural, it's normal, and it's quite easy in such a physical environment to either completely forget that there's a spirit realm, or perhaps just ignore it. And I suspect most of the time we just tend to forget. And yet we do actually have a spiritual and invisible enemy. You can't see him. You can't see them. I doubt if you can. But they're real nonetheless. And what's more, they are active. And it would be very foolish if you and I were to ignore the spirit realm. It would also be very foolish if we got so caught up in it, so immersed in it and pursuing the occult and so on, that we got totally unbalanced. But we do need to have a sufficient awareness of this spirit realm to realize that not everything that happens in this world or in our circumstances is 100% physical or material. And yet, I suspect most of us, most of the time, tend to forget about the spirit realm. And really, that's potentially dangerous. We've all got to be aware and alert and to know what we should be doing about us, because we do have, really, really, a very real enemy. Let's turn in our Bibles, first of all, to 1 Peter chapter 5. And verses 8 and 9. First letter of Peter, and chapter 5, and when we get there, we'll read verses 8 and 9. Now, Peter was an experienced believer, been around quite a while, had walked and talked with Jesus, and eaten meals with him, been through some difficulties himself, and so he knew a thing or two. And he says here in verse 8, "Be sober. Be vigilant." And today's message is entitled Spiritual Warfare, Be Vigilant. And I think Peter means be vigilant. My margin says be watchful. Be sober, be serious minded. Not talking so much about, you know, don't be drunk. That's obviously a good advice as well. But it means take this seriously. You know, be sober minded. Be watchful. Be alert. Why? Just because it's a good thing to do? Well, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Now, if we believe Peter, he says that out there, there is a roaring lion in the form of the devil, who is an adversary. That's an opponent. That's somebody, really, that's not out for your good. The devil's not out to make you stronger. The devil's out to seek whom he may devour. And to devour means, obviously, to seriously wound, to damage, or actually to destroy. And the devil's going about looking for somebody that he can devour. Some he can't. I wonder why. And some he can. I wonder why. And which would you be? Which would I be? If Satan came prowling down your street, are you one whom he could devour, or one whom he could not devour? Well, it says first of all here, be sober. Be vigilant. Be careful. Be awake. Be alert. Because if you're not, if you're dozing, if your eyes are closed spiritually, if you don't even think about the devil's existence, if you're caught up in a million physical material things, so the devil rarely crosses your mind, that's not being terribly vigilant, is it? That's being, well, sleepwalking through a jungle where there is a very powerful, dangerous lion. And it says here, he's our adversary. That's an opponent. That's an enemy. The NET translation says, your enemy, the devil, is on the prowl. Like a roaring lion, he's on the prowl. He's padding along. Whom can he devour? Well, he walks past your house and he looks. Can he devour you? Will he devour you? Well, to what extent are you and I alert, watchful? You know, we mentioned a couple of weeks back, you know, soldiers going into battle. Well, soldiers really ought to be alert. If you're walking into an area where you happen to know there are, you know, mines and enemy soldiers with guns and mortars, you wouldn't just sleepwalk along, would you? Dozing and got your earphones and listening to some pop music. You'd be thinking, ooh, this is hostile enemy territory. I need to be very alert. Look into the distance. Look at those bushes. Look at those buildings. Look at what's moving over in that area over there. And again, it says here, be sober, be vigilant or watchful, because your adversary or your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And verse 9, resist him. Resist. Stand against him. Steadfast in the faith, or steadfast in your faith. So you and I have got to be watchful and alert, and then when he comes, resist him. Take a stance. Stand against him. If we don't do it, well, God's not going to intervene. This is God's instruction. This is God's way of helping us. He says, resist Satan. Stand against him. Don't just bawl and squall and cry and moan and whinge. Stand against your adversary. Steadfast in your faith. And it's not something that just you have to face or just me. It's common to us all. It says, knowing that the same sufferings, the same opposition is experienced by your brethren in the world. You know, all of us potentially are in Satan's crosshairs, because he's going about looking for those whom he may devour. Now, hopefully he can't devour you or me. But then again, if we're not vigilant, if we're not watchful, if the devil rarely crosses our mind, perhaps he can sneak up on us. And again, we don't want to go to the other extreme where, you know, we see a demon in every doorknob, as somebody once phrased it. We had that years and years ago. We met a couple for a visit to a restaurant. It was a pub. And we met them in the early evening, and they were late. And we were sort of hanging about for quite a while, I think, maybe sort of 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour before they turned up. And the explanation they gave us was that the devil had caused a button of the lady's dress to pop off, and it had rolled out of sight, and it had taken them half an hour or more to find the button to put back in her dress. Was that the devil? I don't want to say categorically it wasn't, but I don't think the devil's into knocking buttons off ladies' dresses. I think he has slightly more important things to do with his time. So we don't want to exaggerate the devil's influence and effect, but equally, we don't want to just carry on from one Sabbath to the next thinking that, well, I'm not bothered. Satan's never around me, nor his demons. He's off somewhere in Africa or Afghanistan. No, you better be watchful. He might be coming your way fairly soon. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 6, read verses 10 through 13. Ephesians chapter 6. I'm just reading part of the story here. We'll come back another day to the rest of it. But just want to establish, first of all, that we have to be aware that there is a spiritual realm, and there are dangers for you and me in it if we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. Picking up the story in verse 10, Ephesians chapter 6. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. So Paul says that you and I have got to do a couple of things here. One is be strong. Second is have armor. Be wearing the whole armor of God. No point wearing armor if you're too weak to actually use it, which is why, first of all, you're told to be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. I mean, I saw some heavy armor recently in Madrid. There's a big exhibition there in the Royal Palace of all these sort of soldiers of old, and lots of armor, and even horses, often model horses, full-size scale model horses with armor on them. And some of the armor looked to me pretty heavy. I'm not sure I could have walked very far. I certainly wouldn't have fought very well. You have to be pretty strong to be wearing heavy armor. And so the first thing here is get strong. Verse 10, be strong. The Weymouth translation says, strengthen yourselves in the Lord and in the power which his supreme might imparts. Get strong. Get yourself strong. Not in your strength, because you won't have any. Neither will I, but it says here, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Then when you're strong, get your armor on. Why would you want armor? Can't we just go and lie on the beach in our bikinis and whatnot? That'd be for the ladies, by the way, not us men. But we don't have spiritual bikinis on. Well, we ought not, because Paul says, put on the whole armor of God so that you can stand against the wiles or the schemings or the plots or the designs of the devil. Does that mean the devil is scheming against you and me? Looks like it. Would they be clever schemes? Probably. Would they be devious schemes? I think so. Would they be effective schemes? Well, it depends. If we're not vigilant, not alert, and we're naked in our spiritual sort of bikini or Y fronts, rather than our armor of God, then I guess we can be devoured, which is why Paul says, be strong, put on the whole, the complete armor. Now, you don't need armor just to look good, be photographed taken. Look at me with my armor. Pretty cool, eh? This is for the reason of a battle. Verse 13, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, which we might think we do. But in reality, says Paul, we wrestle. So there is wrestling going on. I mean, Paul would be familiar with that in his day. Think in the various sort of Olympic Games and so on that they had in those days. There were wrestling matches. Greek or Roman, still a style of wrestling today. and, you know, big strong guys, and maybe some gals as well for that matter, would wrestle. Who's going to be the champion? Well, we don't wrestle, says Paul, against just human beings, but we are wrestling, that's fighting, against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts or armies of wickedness in the heavenly places. That appears to be sort of ranks of demons. One called principalities, one called powers, one referred to as the rulers of the dark places of this earth, another group, another rank, spiritual armies in the heavenlies. So potentially an orderly army of at least four ranks. And it says you and I are combating them, which is why we have to have our armor on and be strong. So the idea that you and I can just sort of wander through life half asleep, remote in our hand, watching endless TV programs, picking up our Bibles Sabbath, praying for an enormous 5 minutes every night before we tumble into bed, and thinking that we're soldiers ready to fight, that's not the way it works. Continuing, verse 13, therefore, because you've got these ranks of the spiritual powers who are going to be wrestling with us, therefore take up again the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. When you've finished, you ought to be standing. Stand therefore. And then he goes into the various types of armor, which we'll cover another day. But the point at the moment, just to establish, there is a battle. There is an enemy. In fact, here's several enemies. Principalities, powers, rulers of the world's dark places, and armies of spiritual wickedness in the heavenlies. That's quite a lot. And some of these spirits could be very powerful. And it would be silly for us to just pretend that, well, because I never see a demon, because I've never seen a principality or a power, therefore they're not there. And anyway, I've been around God's church for 25 years, 50 years. They can't bother me. Well, Paul said, be strong in the Lord and make sure that you are fully equipped with the complete armor of God. If you want to stand against the wiles, the schemes, the plots, the plans, the stratagems of the devil. And if you don't, it's implied, he'll get you. He's after you. He's looking for one he may devour. And somebody standing there in their spiritual bikini or spiritual wife fronts is, potential prey for the devil. Let's look at Daniel chapter 10. Read verses 2 through 14. Maybe near last week, I think we were. Daniel chapter 10 gives us an insight into the spirit realm and the bad part of it, and demonstrates that they can interfere in our lives. They've interfered for a while in Daniel's life. We were here, I think, last week. Daniel chapter 10. And this is the story of an angel coming to Daniel with a message, but didn't get there all that quickly, at least not by sort of spiritual standards. Verse 2, in those days I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, so no McDonald's, no KFC. Oh, sorry, I guess that wouldn't be pleasant food, would it? I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. And then verse 5, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with gold of Uphaz! Exclamation mark. So he looks up and, who's that? Just out of the blue, this strange individual, clothed in linen and with his gold girdle. Verse 6, his body was like a beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, his arms and feet like burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. Oh, loud. Who is this individual? And verse 8, I was left alone when I saw this great vision, and no strength remained in me, for my vigor was turned to frailty, and I retained no strength. So Daniel knows that this is a very special being. Appears to be an angel, a very important angel. It's not named, I don't think, anywhere, so I've always tended to assume it was Gabriel, but maybe not. And poor old Daniel sort of falls into a slump. But verse 10, suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. He's feeling a bit weak. He's obviously quite a powerful and, I guess, almost intimidating being. And he said to me, "Oh, Daniel, man greatly beloved." What? Quite something. If an angel comes to you and says, "Oh, Jamie, oh, John, oh, Mary, oh, Agatha, oh, person greatly beloved of God," that's like, ooh. That's quite a statement. And Daniel, obviously, got very fond of him. He said, "Understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you." While he was speaking this word, I stood trembling, still shaking, because this is a clearly very powerful spirit being. And he said to me, "Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words." So it appears, as will become clear in the next verse, that once Daniel went to God and said, "God in heaven, great God of Abraham, I really desire deeper understanding of your purpose and plan." At that point, God said, "Okay, senior angel, go down and give Daniel the rest of the message." That's from the day that Daniel humbled himself, which was 21 days earlier, 3 full weeks. So why the delay? I mean, does it take angels that long to get from God's throne to the earth? Well, I'm not sure how far away it is, but I think they have an ability to move a bit faster than we do, and I would imagine they could get here in a matter of seconds or minutes, perhaps even instantaneously, but not this time. The angel had come after God said in day one, "Go speak to Daniel." But verse 13, "The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And this is a great, powerful angel. And for 3 weeks, he's been unable to get to see Daniel because he's been opposed, held back by someone or some being called the prince of the kingdom of Persia. Well, I mean, would a human prince sitting on a throne, eating his porridge for breakfast, be able to hold back a very powerful angel from God? No, the prince of the kingdom of Persia is another spirit being who has been strong enough to actually stop God's messenger getting through for 3 weeks. And the angel continues, "And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes." Well, we've got a prince of Persia, and Michael, whom we know as the archangel, is called a chief prince. So pretty clearly the prince of Persia is a angel of some sort. And our angel says, "Behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I've been left alone there with the kings of Persia. And now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision refers to many days yet to come." So the angel finally gets to see Daniel, but had been withstood, held back, opposed for 21 days. And you think, well, surely if God sent an angel with a message, it would get through. Surely God has that power. Well, yes, God would have that power. But the point is that in the spirit realm, there are forces, there are principalities, there are powers, there are rulers of the world's darkness, there are wicked spirits in the heavenlies, and they are strong enough, as we see in this particular case, to hold back a powerful angel for 21 days, and it takes another angel, Michael, to turn up and provide the extra power. Drop down to verse 19, or 18, sorry. Just finish off the story. Then again, the one having the likeness of a man touched me and strengthened me and said, O man, greatly beloved, fear not. Peace to you. Be strong. Yes, be strong. So when he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And then he said, Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia, who is an angel of some sort, or a demon, choose your language however you want, but certainly a powerful spirit being. And this man, this angel, says, I'm going back to fight with the prince. And when I've gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come, another principality or power, another spirit being, probably one who will influence the way that the land of Greece goes. I wonder if there's one there today wrecking the country. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth, and then in brackets, no one upholds me against these. I have no help other than Michael, your prince. So the lesson from that is that there are spiritual powers out there. There's the good angels who are God's messengers, and there are other angelic forces who oppose, who get in the way. And just because God announces something must happen doesn't mean necessarily it will happen immediately. Sometimes when you and I ask God for something, as Daniel did here, and we wait, 10 minutes, hasn't happened, and oh, I guess it wasn't God's will. Oh well, I guess that's the end of that then. What, 10 minutes? Or maybe you'll hold on, rock of Gibraltar for a whole day before deciding, I guess it wasn't God's will. Well, my faith couldn't last any more than a day. Well, here's Daniel, and here's an important message to a man greatly beloved. It took 21 days to get through. I always wonder, I think people do wonder, if Daniel had given up after 20 days. Well, had enough of this. Now, where's the wine? Where's the red meat? With my, quarter pounder, and given up. Would the angel have stopped at that point? Oops! Hang on, halt, turn around and go back to heaven. Daniel didn't give up. And so you and I ought to be a bit careful, not to assume because things don't happen immediately that it's God's fault or that God hasn't answered. There is a spirit realm. And of course, when you see that there are princes over Persia and princes over Greece, who are actually very powerful, clearly very powerful beings, because they held back, God's messenger for 21 days. Are there angelic princes over Iran, over Iraq, over Syria, over the USA, over various countries? Will they influence what takes place in those countries? That's speculation, but as far as I'm aware, Satan's demons are still on the earth. They're not yet locked up. So if they were active in Daniel's day, I would make an assumption they're still active today. Well, let's turn to James chapter 4 and read verses 6 and 7. Again, just trying to establish that there is a spirit realm, and you and I are pretty foolish if we don't even think about it. It hasn't gone away. James chapter 4. I'm reading verses 6 and 7. But God gives more grace, and therefore he says, God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. Good reason why you and I ought not to be proud. wouldn't want God to be resisting us, would we? But if you and I are humble, then God can give us grace, which strengthens us. Grace is a great topic. I've spoken on it a few times before. Don't think I've ever really properly done it. One of those topics you think, well, I think I know what I want to say, but it never comes out very, very well. But grace is super important. Grace is the power that works in us to strengthen us. And then in verse 7 it says, therefore submit to God, who can thereby strengthen us, and resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So James is pointing out, well, the devil's there, and clearly if you're going to resist him, that must mean he's after you. He's trying to get to you. He's trying to employ some strategy, some scheme, some wile, trying to devour you. In other words, he is there and you're exposed. And James says, submit to God, or be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Have on the whole armor of God, and then resist. And resist means stand against. And sometimes, we think we should just get on our knees and pray, oh God, please take away Satan. Oh God, please get the devil out of my life. Oh God, please do this to the devil. Do that to the devil. Well, what God's saying is actually, you resist the devil. You stand against the devil. You be vigilant. You put on the armor. You take the sword. No point in us asking God to do things that he's actually told us that we're supposed to be doing. And here it says very clearly, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. There's a story of one well-known evangelist who was at Ambassador College way back. This must be the 50s, I think it was. And as he was crossing the campus, that'd be Pasadena, I'm pretty sure, he heard this voice saying, go and kill that man. This is a guy who's still an evangelist today. I'll not name him in case he doesn't want the story repeating, but he heard this voice saying, kill that man. And then he, and what he did was he dived into the bushes on the campus, wrapped his arms around a sort of tree trunk and prayed desperately for God to take the thoughts out of his mind. Well, in a sense, grabbing the tree trunk was a good idea, but God says, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. Can't really ask God to do it for you. It's up to us to resist the devil. Thankfully, he didn't kill the other person, otherwise he wouldn't be the evangelist he is today. He'd probably be in prison somewhere. So James says, submit to God, or be strong in God's power and might, and then resist, stand against the devil. Then what? The devil will thump you, pound you, batter you as you resist him? No, it suggests the devil doesn't really want a battle with a believer. You stand against him and it says he will flee. I think one translation says flee as in terror from you. Not me, but I'm just little old me. Surely big nasty Satan with these pitchfork and his pointy tail and his horns and all red colored, surely I should be frightened of him and flee from him. The scripture says you stand against him and he'll flee from you, run from you, run away from you. And the Message translation says, let God work his will in you, yell aloud no to the devil and watch him scamper. Well, I think it's probably more than scamper. I think it's run as in terror if you stand against him. But of course, we're not even aware he's there, because we don't think anything about the devil, because after all that's just spiritual stuff. We won't be resisting, we won't be fighting, we won't be armoured, we'll be totally unaware, in which case advantage devil. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 2 verses 10 and 11. 2 Corinthians 2. So again, we don't want to get tied up in knots over the occult and Ouija boards and seances and reading tons and tons about witchcraft and all that carry on, get to the point where it occupies our mind day and night. But equally, we don't want to get to the other extreme of thinking everything is just physical. And that's all my problems are just flesh and blood. There's nothing else to it. It's just me and people. Well, that's not what Paul said earlier. he says, we don't wrestle against human beings, but against, and then he outlines, you know, at least four apparent ranks in Satan's spiritual realm. We're in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, and Paul's been writing to the Corinthians about, you know, earlier problems they had. Remember the man who was living with his stepmother, and the Corinthians had been quite proud of the tolerance, and Paul jumped all over them and said, you need to dump that guy, get rid of him, because he's going to destroy the congregation. And it seems the man had turned around and eventually repented, and now there were further problems because the Corinthians were not really prepared, in a sense, to have him back. Or if they were, you know, he was still under suspicion, and they were probably avoiding him. And so Paul was more or less saying, look, you need to forgive this guy. If he has repented, which apparently he has, forgive the guy, and in fact, more than forgive him, actually welcome him back. Otherwise, you see, you're going to leave yourselves open. And that's bringing us down to verse 10. Now, whom you forgive anything, talking, I think, of this individual who'd caused the problems in the prior months. Now, whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. If indeed I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. The point he was making was, look, if you don't forgive this guy, if you don't welcome him back, if there's hostility, if there is strife, then you're opening up the congregation, yourselves, to Satan. He says you need to forgive, get this thing sorted out, get back to a loving relationship, lest, verse 11, lest Satan should take advantage of us. For we're not ignorant of his schemes, his stratagems, his devices, his purposes. Satan will exploit a church, a congregation, a family, if there is strife. Great for Satan. Strife? Hostility? Hatred? Envy? Jealousy? Gossip? Rumor? Oh, grist to Satan's mill. And Paul says, don't allow that. Don't allow that strife to be there. You're almost throwing the door open and saying, Satan, come and get us. Once you get friction and upset, then the problems can get bigger than just people, because, you know, if it was just people, it would just be people. But Paul's saying, no, you're not just people. You are people at whom, you know, Satan is looking. Satan's going about prowling. Whom can he devour? Oh, look at this congregation. Look at the envy. Look at the hatred. Look at the gossip. Look at the strife. Oh, all the ingredients that I want to devour and destroy. So Paul says, fix it. Forgive. Accept. Restore to a loving relationship. And because we're not unaware, are we, of Satan's devices? Well, the point probably is that yes, probably, very often we are sleepwalking through hostile territory. Not wise. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 24 to 26. 2 Timothy chapter 2. So the danger is that we just, you know, live from day to day purely as if everything was physical, material. Get up in the morning, the alarm goes off, and we throw it across the room, stumble out of bed, go and munch our Wheaty Bangs, which, by the way, are not an actual product you can buy in Kmart or wherever. Have your porridge, your yogurt, whatever. Then get in the car, or whatever you do. Watch your TV for, you know, 10 hours. Cutting back now. But watch out. There's a spirit realm. 2 Timothy chapter 20. Chapter 2, verse 24. A servant of the Lord, I guess meaning a minister, must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, being able to teach is really, I guess, one of the key criteria for a minister. There's nothing else he can do. Maybe he can't cook or, you know, paint a wall or change a car engine. But one thing he ought to be able to do is able to teach. That's his fundamental job, teaching. Verse 25, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth, and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. So here's people who have been captured by the devil. And it says, you know, the minister, the teacher, like Timothy, should endeavor to teach patiently, so that hopefully some of these people, who might well have been believers, might come to their senses, verse 26, and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him. Oops. You mean the devil could take believers captive? Rather looks like it. The NET translation says, will come to their senses and escape the devil's trap, where they are held captive to do his will. Oh. So some people, I'm thinking, because it's addressed to Timothy, who's dealing with church people, a congregation that Paul has in mind, some of the believers that are in this category, they've let their guard down. They've allowed Satan to take advantage, to obtain opportunity in their lives. And the point is, there is a battle. It's a real battle. And like all battles, there will be victims. Some will be defeated. Even though you and I should always be victors, always walk in triumph, that requires us to be strong in the Lord and put on the whole armor of God and not be unaware of Satan's devices. But if we don't do those things, if we just, you know, not paying attention, being lazy Christians, 5 minutes prayer a day and 5 minutes Bible study a week. I don't class necessarily listening to a message on Sabbath as exactly Bible study. I mean, we call it Bible study, but, you know, people are listening, somebody's talking. That's better than nothing. But what about the personal study? Is you and the Bible and, of course, God. So watch out. And so we can see that the scriptures are fairly plain. There is a devil. There are demons. They are real. And they can have many different types of influence and effect upon people. Look at Luke chapter 13, verses 10 through 17. Luke 13. Luke 13 and verses 10 through 17. Can the devil affect people? Well, verse 10. Now Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity 18 years, and was bent over, and could in no way raise herself up. Now when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said, Woman, you are loosed from your infirmity. And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. So a fantastic miracle. Here's a lady who's been bent over for 18 years. We don't know what age she was, whether she was 50 or 60 at this time, or maybe just 35 or 40. But a large chunk of her life she's bent over, bent double. That's pretty unpleasant. You can't stand up straight, probably can't sit comfortably, can't get your clothes on and off because you can't straighten up. And maybe if she was that way when she was younger, perhaps she never got married, never had a family, we don't know. But here's a fantastic miracle. And what caused it? A spirit of illness, a spirit of infirmity, kept her bent double for all those years. And of course, such a fantastic miracle, everybody shouted and jumped for joy and said hallelujah. Not, verse 14, but the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. Not allowable to our friendly synagogue ruler. And he said to the crowd, there are 6 days in which men ought to work. Therefore, come and be healed on them and not on the Sabbath day. And you've got to really be quite depressed at human beings. And this lady who's been fantastically healed, what a great day for her and the congregation. And the guy in charge can only think about, you know, the petty man-made rules of Sabbath keeping that the Pharisees had concocted over the years. And he's busy chiding Jesus for, I mean, it's just almost unbelievable. Thankfully, Jesus didn't take it for a moment. The Lord then answered him and said, you pretender, you hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead it away to water it? Look after your animals, and rightly so. So ought not this woman, being a human being, being also a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound. Think of it, for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath. So who's behind it? Now, if we take Jesus' words, and I'm prepared to do that, Satan had bound this woman, crippled her, for nearly 20 years. When he said these things, all his adversaries were put to shame, and serves him right. And all the multitude rejoiced for all the glorious things that were done by him. So clearly, at least some ailments, some illnesses are associated with Satan and demons. Not all, but definitely some. Look at Mark chapter 9, verses 17 to 27. Mark chapter 9. Verses 17 through 27. I'm dawdling, you can see by the clock. Another attempt to move on. Mark 9, 17 to 27. Then one of the multitude answered and said, Teacher, talking to Jesus, I brought you my son who is a mute spirit, so can't speak, probably can't hear. Wherever he seizes him, this spirit, he throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast him out, but they could not. So here's a spirit that causes dumbness, appears to be epilepsy, possibly deafness as well. He's a mute spirit, which catches the boy from time to time, and he goes rigid, foams at the mouth. Falls over. Pretty horrific. So horrific it put the disciples right off and they were stumped. And Jesus answered and said, Oh, faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me. The disciples ought to have handled this. But clearly when this young boy started, you know, foaming in the mouth and started thrashing around and going rigid, the faith they had went out the door in a hurry. And they just went by evidence of our eyes, physical senses, walked by sight, not by faith. And they blew it. It was just such a horrible sight. Of course, it made no difference to Jesus. His faith was a million times stronger than that. He wasn't affected in the slightest. But then they brought him to him. And when he, the boy, saw Jesus, immediately the spirit convulsed him. And he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. I mean, pretty horrific sight. And Jesus said to the father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, well, from childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. So can demons affect people? Yep. Deafness, probably. Dumbness, definitely. Epilepsy, apparently. And self-harm, you know, into the fire, into the water. If you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. You know, nothing to do with me, Lord, but if you can do anything, Jesus. And Jesus didn't stand for that either. He says, hang on a second. If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Don't just look at me, mate. If you can believe, you need to be doing something here too. If you can believe anything, everything is possible to him who believes. And immediately the father of the child cried out, and with tears, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying, "You deaf," "you deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more." Then the spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, and came out of him. And he became as one dead, just lying there, lifeless, motionless. So they said, "Well, he's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. So deafness, dumbness, epilepsy, linked to a spirit in somebody. Look at Matthew 12, verses 22 to 29. Matthew 12, verses 22 to 29. Then was brought to Jesus one who was demon-possessed, blind, and mute. So, I guess deaf and dumb, also blind. Pretty horrible position to be in. You can't see anything, you can't hear anything, you can't speak. And you're almost detached. All you can do is feel. That's a horrible condition brought about by what? A demon. A spirit. It wasn't just physical problems with the ears, or physical problems with the eyes, or physical problems with the tongue. There's a demon here, a spirit being, causing this individual, I'm guessing it's a male, but doesn't say so, when he does, he healed him. So the blind and mute man both spoke and saw. And all the multitudes were amazed and said, "Oh, you think this could be the son of David?" When the Pharisees heard it, they said, "This fellow does not cast out demons except by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons." And their eyes, you know, there was a ruler over the demons. And Jesus didn't disagree. He knew their thoughts and said to them, "Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation. Every city or house divided against itself will not stand. If Satan casts out Satan, he is divided against himself, and how then will his kingdom stand?" So Jesus says, essentially, you know, Satan has a spiritual kingdom. Principalities, powers, rulers of this world's dark places, and wicked spirits in the heavenlies. Verse 27, "If I cast out demons by Beelzebub, as you allege, well, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore they'll be your judges. But if I cast out demons by the Spirit of God, surely the kingdom of God has come upon you. Or else, how can one enter a strong man's house," or I think the Greek says, "the strong man's house, and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man, and then he will plunder his house?" Jesus implying that he's able to bind the strong man and then plunder Satan's household. So demons can cause all manner of problems, and Jesus pretty much implies there the devil has a kingdom. Look at Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 17. Mark chapter 5. We're just establishing again by a number of scriptures that there is a genuine spirit realm, and that they're not just off there somewhere in the atmosphere amusing themselves. They are able to influence and affect mankind. Verse 1, "Then they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gadarenes, and when Jesus had come out of the boat, immediately they met him out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs." Odd place to be, but spirits, I guess, affect your mind. "And no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him. and the shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him. He was a wild man. Strong enough that you put chains around his ankles and arms and his wrists. You know, like maybe handcuffs on a prisoner today. This guy just goes, woof! Snaps the chains. Snaps the shackles. Bursts them into pieces. Why? Well, the demon clearly makes this guy super strong. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones, you know, self-harm. There's some of that around today. So these demons can influence and affect this, make this guy extremely strong, but also cuts himself and chops his, you know, lacerates his arms and legs and chest and so on. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him and cried out with a loud voice and said, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me." Well, it wasn't, of course, the man who had been tormented by Jesus. It was the demons there. For Jesus said to him, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." Then he asked him, "What is your name?" And he answered, saying, "My name is Legion, for we are many." So by the sound of it, there were a large number of demons camped inside this individual, giving him this super strength, but also this desire to harm himself. Wild, mad, untamable. And he begged him earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. Must be some reason why they liked that particular neck of the woods. Perhaps people were more open to being demon influenced there. And a large herd of swine, verse 11, was feeding there near the mountains. And all the demons, all X number, begged him, saying, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." And you wonder, well, why do you want to do that? And it seems that the demons don't like being just sort of disembodied, I think is the word, just sort of floating around. They want something physical because they live in a physical world, but they can't do a lot with it. I mean, I can reach out and touch a table and a chair, and I can go grab an apple, and I can, you know, move a table or a chair around. I can move a car from A to B, but spirit beings apparently can't do much. They don't have a body. They're not, no physical connection. But of course, if they possess something like this man, well, then they can do things. They can get the man to do things on their behalf. And apparently they want to be in some sort of body, even if it's an animal's body. "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." And at once Jesus gave them permission, and the unclean spirits went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000. If that indicates anything about the number of demons. "And the herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea. Now those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city and in the country, and they went out to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind." Totally healed, calm, thinking, logical. Got his clothes on now, listening to Jesus, and probably one of the happiest men on the earth. But these people were afraid, and those who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine, and they began to plead with him to depart from the region. "Get out, Jesus. Go away, Jesus." And when he got into the boat, because he hated them, he'd been demon-possessed, begged that he might be with them, and Jesus did not permit him, but said, "Go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you, and how he's had compassion on you." And so he departed. But a great miracle, but equally it shows you that demons can have a big influence. Look at Luke 11, 24 to 26. Luke chapter 11. And you might be thinking, well, all these things are happening in the Gospels. You know, once Jesus was crucified and resurrected and went back to heaven, and the Spirit came, Pentecost, well, doesn't affect us, does it? These are just Old Testament things and Gospel things. Well, Luke 11, 24 and 26. Before we answer that question, here we read, when an unclean spirit goes out of a man or woman, he goes through dry places seeking rest. And finding none, he says, I'll return to my house from which I came. So, like the demons, they didn't want to be cast out of the man. They said, oh, can we enter those pigs over there? But it seems that demons don't like being disembodied, just floating around, rather sort of aimlessly. And so it says here that, you know, he looks for some place that he can abide, settle down. And finding none, he says, I'll return to my house, the body, from which I came. When he comes, he finds it swept and put in order, but potentially empty, not being filled up with the good things. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they, all seven or eight, I guess now, enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. So the demons are looking for somewhere to reside, to settle down. Now, they can't just barge in. We'll cover that perhaps next week. They don't just come and overcome you. But on the other hand, if the door's open, if opportunity is presented, then they can. And of course, some people who've had demons cast out sort of miss them. Didn't really want to lose their demon powers and their familiar spirits. And so sometimes problems can arise because they come back big time. And that's even worse, isn't it? Look at Acts chapter 16, verses 16 to 24. Acts 16, beginning verse 16. This is long after Jesus has been crucified and resurrected. This is a good many years after the Holy Spirit came. This is the days of the church. But demons are still active. Picking up here in verse 16. Now it happened as we went to prayer, Luke is writing of him and Paul, that a certain slave girl possessed with a spirit of divination met us, who brought her masters much profit by fortune telling. Still some around today, I guess. And, you know, the thing is that spirits can't actually tell the future. Demons can't look into the future. But of course, demons can eavesdrop on conversations, can know what people are planning to do, can pass that inside confidential information along to other people. You know, when certain people like John F. Kennedy were assassinated, there were plots and plans, there were conversations taking place about when and who and what position and what time of day. And demons can pick up those conversations and relay them to others. Jean Dixon, did she say that she understood these things in advance? It's not really fortune telling. It's not the future. It's just passing on the plans of men and women. If those plans got halt for some reason, then the demon's story would come to halt, because when he's passing on information, they're not seeing themselves literally into the future. This girl followed Paul and us and cried out, saying, these men are the servants of the Most High God, who proclaim to us the way of salvation. Or I think it says a way of salvation. And this she did for many days, but Paul, greatly annoyed, didn't want the endorsement of some demonically inspired person, turned and said to the spirit, I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And he came out that very hour. But when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, hang on, she can't fortune tell any longer, our money's gone, we're sunk on the dole. They seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to the authorities, and they brought them to the magistrates and said, these men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city. And then, of course, trouble erupted and Paul and the others got beaten up. So here's a young woman with a spirit of divination, a spirit of fortune-telling, and still happens today. I mean, we've probably all had experiences, I guess, in our lives of some people just looking at us and coming across and talking to us about our beliefs, thinking, where did that come from? You know, there's demons out there. Look at Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. Ephesians 2. Have the demons all gone away now that Jesus has gone to heaven? Or is this just something for old covenant times? Because obviously the gospel, some people would point out, are essentially old covenant, because Jesus came, you know, as a Jew living in Jewish times, and the old covenant still existed, the temple was still there. Some people say, well, you've got to stick the gospels in with the Old Testament. It's only after Acts chapter 2 that we have the church era. Well, if that's the case, which is not, by the way, then Ephesians 2 tells us that demons are still around today. Ephesians 2 verses 1 through 3. And you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins in which you once walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who right now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. What did Paul say to the Ephesians? The prince of the power of the air, the spirit who is right now working in the sons of disobedience. The word for prince is in Greek is archon, A-R-C-H-O-N, which is what we read of back in Ephesians chapter 6. Principalities and powers. Other translations say the ruler of the kingdom of the air. Another translation says the ruler of the spiritual powers in space. And the spirit who right now controls or energizes the children of disobedience. That's right now today. There are many people today who are energized by Satan and his spirits. They can affect circumstances. And you and I cannot afford to let our guard down. You know, there's a roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour. Now, we're looking at spirits generally, the ones that you and I might bump into, but the scriptures point out there are some demon spirits who are so powerful and so dangerous that they're currently actually locked away, at least for a while. Look at 2 Peter 2 and verse 4. Now, these ones we won't come across, probably. Don't think we will, not until perhaps the very end. But just painting the bigger picture of all these fallen angels, as I guess we think they are, these spiritual forces, these principalities and powers, some of them are really bad, really, really bad, but they're not currently allowed to interfere with us. 2 Peter 2 and verse 4, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to Tartarus, that's what the Greek is, not Hades or Gehenna, it only appears here in the New Testament, Tartarus, and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. And it carries on. So here are certain angels who sinned, and God has them currently chained up, reserved, kept for a yet future judgment, and they're in a place called Tartarus. Place of darkness, but they are not on the earth, not strutting their stuff, so to speak. These angels who sinned are in Tartarus, and they're locked away and chained. They're not going to be affecting you and me. Look at Jude verse 6, there's only one chapter in Jude, so chapter 1 if you want, but Jude verse 6. So I'm guessing that these angels were just too hazardous to allow to wander around the earth, so they're in chains of darkness and reserved, kept, hidden for judgment. But Jude, verse 6, something very similar. And the angels who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own habitation, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Now, we know elsewhere it says that you and I will judge angels. So I guess it might be these particular ones that we're going to judge, or them and others. But it says here quite clearly, these angels that didn't stay where they ought to have stayed are reserved in chains. So these are not the ones that were in Legion. These are not the ones that caused the lady to be bent over, crippled. These are not the ones that made people mute and blind and epileptics. These aren't the ones that gave fortune-telling powers to the girl in Acts 16. These ones are out the way. They're not around. They're just too dangerous. Let's turn to Revelation 9, because I think this is now speculation. They might be released, possibly, at the very end, just to add to man's problems. Revelation 9, and read verses 1 through 11. This part is speculation, so I'm not saying this is absolutely right. But when you get to the book of Revelation, there are lots of symbols, and they're not all, as you know, crystal clear. When we get to chapter 9, we're making our way through the trumpets. This is trumpet number 5, verse 1. Then the fifth angel sounded his trumpet. And I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth. And to him, the stars very often, picture angels. It says, to him was given the key to the bottomless pit, or my margin says, to the shaft of the abyss. Symbolic? Or, shaft to the abyss, or a bottomless pit, something that goes down deep, and there's a key so you can open it up. What are we on about? And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Now, we've got ideas, of course, of what all this means, but I think just be careful, we're not being absolutely sure. Out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. These locusts were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree, which is strange because locusts typically eat foliage, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not given authority to kill the men, but to torment them for 5 long months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days men will seek death and will not find it, will desire to die, and death will flee from them. Very mysterious. But these locusts, which go out of the bottomless pit, seem to avoid foliage, but seem to torment and men with some sort of like a toxin that doesn't kill men, but leaves them in agony for 5 months. And the shape of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle, and their heads were crowns of something like gold. Their faces like the faces of men, they had hair like women's hair, teeth were like lion's teeth. What on earth are these? We speculated, is this some sort of like military weaponry? Are they tanks or helicopters or whatever? But let's face it, we're struggling. And they had breastplates like the breastplates of iron. The sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running to battle. They had tails like scorpions. What are these? There were stings in their tails. And their power was to hurt men 5 months. But hang on, verse 11. They had a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon. But in Greek he has the name Apollyon, both which mean essentially destroyer. So strangely enough, these locusts, which are released from this shaft of the abyss, have an angelic king, the destroyer, Abaddon, and Apollyon. So it's speculation. Is it possible that some of these angels who've been locked away for a long time may be released at the end? Certainly would add a lot of further problems to this earth. That would be what you might class as supernaturally bad times. So, you know, summarizing for today, there's plenty of evidence that Satan and his demons are around, and the reality is that many of the problems and difficulties and obstacles that you and I face are demonic in origin, right from the Garden of Eden through the flood of Noah, which I've skipped today through lack of time, right down to today. So let's finish in 1 Peter 5:8. I finish for today at least. 1 Peter 5:8, where we began. Because bearing in mind what we've said about demons and fallen angels and things locked away in chains and the mutes and epileptics and crippled people and all that stuff, was Peter right when he wrote in 5:8? Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. So today's message is entitled Spiritual Warfare, Be Vigilant. And I think that's the final comment as we end, is be vigilant. Okay, with that we'll conclude today's Bible study.